A Dream of Armageddon by H.G. Wells. Part 2. I might have gone back, I think, and saved the world. The people of the North would follow me, I knew, granted only that in one thing, I respected their moral standards. And I knew I had only to put it to her, and she would have let me go. Only I did not want to go. My will was all the other way about. I had so newly thrown off the incubus of responsibility. I was still so fresh a renegade from duty that the daylight clearness of what I ought to do had no power at all to touch my will. But though this sense of vast neglected duties had no power to draw me, it could make me silent and preoccupied. It robbed the days I had spent of half their brightness, and roused me into dark meditations in the silence of the night. And as I stood and watched Evesham's aeroplane sweep to and fro, those birds of infinite ill omen, she stood beside me, watching me, perceiving the trouble indeed, her eyes questioning my face, her expression shaded with perplexity. It was the sense of her that roused me from my mood. I turned upon her suddenly and challenged her to race down the mountain slopes. "No," she said, as if I had jarred with her gravity, but I was resolved to end that gravity and make her run. No one can be very sad who is out of breath. And when she stumbled, I ran with my hand beneath her arm. We ran down past a couple of men, who turned back, staring in astonishment at my behaviour. They must have recognised my face. And halfway down the slope came a tumult in the air. Clang, clank, clang, clank. And we stopped. And presently, over the hill crest, those war things came flying, one behind the other. The man seemed hesitating on the verge of a description. "What were they like?" I asked. "They had never fought," he said. "They were just like our ironclads are nowadays. They had never fought. No one knew what they might do. They were great driving things shaped like spearheads without a shaft, with a propeller in the place of the shaft."
"And they carried guns?"
"Little guns, firing high-explosive shells. They fired the guns backwards, out of the base of the leaf, so to speak, and rammed with the beak. That was the theory, you know, but they had never been fought. No one could tell exactly what was going to happen. And meanwhile, I suppose it was very fine to go whirling through the air like a flight of young swallows, swift and easy. I guess the captains tried not to think too clearly what the real thing would be like. And these flying war machines, you know, were only one sort of the endless war contrivances that had been invented and had fallen into abeyance during the long peace. You know the silly way of these ingenious sort of men who make these things. They turn them out as beavers build dams, with no more sense of the rivers they're going to divert and the lands they're going to flood. As we went down the winding stepway to our hotel again, in the twilight, I foresaw it all. I saw how clearly and inevitably things were driving for war in Evesham's silly, violent hands. And I had some inkling of what war was bound to be under these new conditions. And even then, though I knew it was drawing near the limit of my opportunity, I could find no will to go back. He sighed. "She counseled me to go back. My dearest," she said, and her sweet face looked up to me. "This is death. This life you lead is death. Go back to them. Go back to your duty." She began to weep, saying between her sobs and clinging to my arm as she said it, "Go back. Go back." Then suddenly she fell mute, and glancing down at her face, I read in an instant the thing she had thought to do. It was one of those moments when one sees. "No," I said, "nothing shall send me back. Nothing. I have chosen. Whatever happens, I will live this life. I will live for you, even if you died." "Yes," she murmured softly. "Then I also would die." And before she could speak again, I began to talk, talking eloquently, as I could do in that life, talking to exalt love, to make the life we were living seem heroic and glorious, and the thing I was deserting something hard and enormously ignoble, that it was a fine thing to set aside. I bent all my mind to throw that glamour upon it, seeking not only to convert her, but myself to that. And so my moment passed. It was my last chance. The leaders of the South and East were gathering their resolve, and the hot answer that shattered Evesham's bluffing forever took shape and waited. The air and the wires were throbbing with warnings to prepare, prepare. No one living, you know, knew what war was. No one could imagine, with all these new inventions, what horror war might bring. I believe most people still believed it would be a matter of bright uniforms and shouting charges and triumphs and flags and bands, in a time when half the world drew its food supply from regions 10,000 miles away. The man with the white face paused. A little railway station, a signal box shot by the carriage window, and a bridge passed with a clap of noise, echoing the tumult of the train. After that, he said, I dreamt often. For 3 weeks of nights, that dream was my life. And the worst of it was that there were nights when I could not dream, when I lay tossing on a bed in this accursed life. And there, somewhere lost to me, things were happening, momentous, terrible things. I lived at nights. My days, my waking days, this life I am living now, became a faded, faraway dream. I could tell you all, every little thing in the dream, but as to what I did in the daytime, no, I could not tell. I do not remember. My memory has gone. The business of life slips from me. He pressed his hands upon his eyes. For a long time he said nothing. And then, said I, the war burst like a hurricane. He stared before him at unspeakable things. One touch of unreality, he said in the low tone of a man who speaks to himself, and they would have been nightmares. But they were not nightmares. No. He was silent for so long that it dawned upon me that there was a danger of losing the rest of the story. But he went on talking again, in the same tone of questioning self-communion. What was there to do but flight? I had not thought the war would touch Capri. But 2 nights after, the whole place was shouting and bawling. Every woman almost and every other man wore a badge, Evesham's badge. And there was no music but a jangling war song over and over again, and everywhere men enlisting. The whole island was awhirl with rumours. It was said again and again that fighting had begun. I had not expected this. I had seen so little of the life of pleasure that I had failed to reckon with this violence of the amateurs. The crowd jostled us and bawled in our ears. That accursed song deafened us. A woman shrieked at my lady because no badge was on her, and we too went back to our own place again, my lady white and silent, and I a-quiver with rage. So furious was I could have quarrelled with her if I could have found one shade of accusation in her eyes. I walked up and down our rock cell. "We must get out of this place," I said over and over. "I have made my choice, and I will have no hand in these troubles. I will have nothing of this war. This is no refuge for us. Let us go." And the next day we were already in flight from the war that covered the world. And all the rest was flight. All the rest was flight. He mused darkly. I tried to draw him back to his story with questions. "Where did you go?" I said. "When?" "When you left Capri." "Southwest," he said, and glanced at me for a second. "We went in a boat." "But I should have thought an aeroplane." They had been seized.
He broke out in an argumentative monotone.
But why should it be? If indeed this battle, this slaughter and stress is life, why have we this craving for pleasure and beauty? If there is no refuge, if there is no place of peace, and if all our dreams of quiet places are a folly and a snare, why have we such dreams? Love had come to me, more glorious than all else in life, and summoned me away. I had silenced all the voices, I had answered all the questions, and suddenly there was nothing but war and death.
I had an inspiration. After all, I said, it could have been only a dream.
A dream, he cried, flaming upon me. A dream, when even now...
For the first time he became animated. A faint flush crept into his cheek. He spoke, looking away from me, and for all the rest of the time he looked away.
We are but phantoms, he said, and the phantoms of phantoms, desires like cloud shadows and wills of straw that eddy in the wind. But one thing is real and certain, one thing is no dream stuff, but eternal and enduring. It is the centre of my life, and all other things about it are subordinate. I loved her, that woman of a dream, and she and I are dead together. A dream? How can it be a dream when it drenched a living life with unappeasable sorrow, when it makes all that I have lived for and cared for worthless and unmeaning? Until that very moment when she was killed, I believe we still had a chance of getting away, he said. All through the night and morning that we sailed across the sea from Capri to Salerno, we talked of escape. We were full of hope, and it clung about us to the end. Hope for the life together we should lead, out of it all, out of the battle and struggle, the wild and empty passions. We were uplifted, as though our quest was a holy thing, as though love for another was a mission. Even when from our boat we saw the fair face of that great rock Capri, already scarred and gashed by the gun emplacements, we reckoned nothing of the imminent slaughter. It is love and reason, I said, fleeing from all this madness of war. And though we presently saw a squadron of aeroplanes flying across the southern sky, we did not heed it. There it was, a line of little dots in the sky, and then more, dotting the southeastern horizon, and then still more, until all that quarter of the sky was stippled with blue specks. They came, rising and falling and growing larger, like some huge flight of gulls, moving with a marvellous uniformity as they spread over a greater width of sky. Suddenly they swept round to the eastward and streamed eastward, growing smaller and smaller and clearer again until they vanished from the sky. And after that we noted to the northward and very high Evesham's fighting machines hanging high over Naples like an evening swarm of gnats. It seemed to have no more to do with us than a flight of birds. Even the mutter of guns far away in the southeast seemed to us to signify nothing. Each day, each dream after that, we were still exalted, still seeking that refuge where we might live and love. Fatigue had come upon us, pain and many distresses. For though we were dusty and stained by our toilsome tramping, and half-starved and with the horror of the dead men we had seen and the flight of the peasants, for very soon a gust of fighting swept up the peninsula, with these things haunting our minds, it still resulted only in a deepening resolution to escape. Oh, but she was brave and patient. She, who had never faced hardship and exposure, had courage for herself and me. We went to and fro, seeking an outlet, over a country all commandeered and ransacked by the gathering hosts of war. Always we went on foot. We had landed at Salerno, and we had been turned back from Cava, and we had tried to cross towards Taranto by a pass over Mount Alberno, but we had been driven back for want of food. So we had come down among the marshes by Pestum, where the great temples stand alone. I had some vague idea that by Pestum it might be possible to find a boat or something, and take once more to sea. and there it was the battle overtook us. A sort of soul blindness had me. Plainly I could see that we were being hemmed in, that the great net of that giant warfare had us in its toils. But all these things do not matter now, these nights of flight and pain. We were in an open place near those great temples at Pestum, at last on a blank stony place dotted with spiky bushes, empty and desolate, and so flat that a grove of eucalyptus far away showed to the feet of its stems. How I can see it! My lady was sitting down under a bush, resting a little, for she was very weak and weary, and I was standing up, watching to see if I could tell the distance of the firing that came and went. They were still, you know, fighting far from each other, with those terrible new weapons that had never before been used, guns that would carry beyond sight, and aeroplanes that would do what they would do no man could foretell. I knew that we were between the two armies, and that they drew together. I knew we were in danger, and that we could not stop there and rest. Though all these things were in my mind, they were in the background. Chiefly I was thinking of my lady. An aching distress filled me. For the first time she had owned herself beaten. Behind me I could hear her sobbing, but I would not turn round to her, because I knew she had need of weeping, and had held herself so far and so long for me. It was well, I thought, that she would weep and rest, and then we would toil on again. Even now I can see her as she sat there, her lovely hair upon her shoulder, can mark again the deepening hollow of her cheek. And then, overhead in the sky flashed something and burst, and all about us I heard the bullets making a noise like a handful of peas suddenly thrown. They chipped the stones about us, and whirled fragments from the bricks, and passed. He put his hand to his mouth, and then moistened his lips. At the flash, I had turned about. You know, she stood up. She stood up and moved a step towards me, as though she wanted to reach me. And she had been shot through the heart. He stopped and stared at me. I felt all that foolish incapacity an Englishman feels on such occasions. I met his eyes for a moment, and then stared out of the window. For a long space we kept silence. When at last I looked at him, he was sitting back in his corner, his arms folded, and his teeth gnawing at his knuckles. "I carried her," he said, "towards the temples in my arms. I don't know why. They seemed a sort of sanctuary, you know. She must have died almost instantly. Only I talked to her all the way." Silence again. "I have seen those temples," I said abruptly. And indeed he had brought those still, sunlit arcades of worn sandstone very vividly before me. "It was the brown one, the big brown one." I sat down on a fallen pillar and held her in my arms. And after a little while, the lizards came out and ran about again, as though nothing unusual was going on, as though nothing had changed. 3 or 4 times shells burst about the beach, and then that ceased. Each time that happened, all the lizards scuttled in and hid for a space. That was all the mischief done, except that once a stray bullet gashed the stone hard by, made just a fresh, bright surface. "The curious thing," he remarked with the manner of a man who makes a trivial conversation, "is that I didn't think at all. I sat with her in my arms amidst the stones in a sort of lethargy, stagnant. And I don't remember waking up. I don't remember dressing that day. I know I found myself in my office with my letters all slit open in front of me, and how I was struck by the absurdity of being there, seeing that in reality I was sitting stunned in that Pestum temple with a dead woman in my arms." He stopped, and there was a long silence. Suddenly I perceived that we were running down the incline from Chalk Farm to Euston. I started at this passing of time. I turned on him with a brutal question, with the tone of now or never.
And did you dream again?
Yes. He seemed to force himself to finish. His voice was very low. Once more, I seemed to have suddenly awakened out of a great apathy, to have risen into a sitting position, and the body lay there on the stones beside me. A gaunt body. Not her, you know. So soon. It was not her. I may have heard voices, I do not know. Only I knew clearly that men were coming into the solitude and that that was a last outrage. I stood up and walked through the temple, and then there came into sight first one man, dressed in a uniform of dirty white trimmed with blue, and then several, climbing to the crest of the old wall of the vanished city and crouching there. They were little bright figures in the sunlight, and there they hung, weapon in hand, peering cautiously before them. And further away I saw others, and then more at another point in the wall. Presently the man I had first seen stood up and shouted a command, and his men came tumbling down the wall and into the high weeds towards the temple. He came facing towards me, and when he saw me, he stopped. At first I had watched these men with a mere curiosity, but when I had seen they meant to come to the temple, I was moved to forbid them. I shouted to the officer. "You must not come here," I cried. "I am here. I am here with my dead." He stared, and then shouted a question back to me in some unknown tongue. I repeated what I had said. He shouted again, and I folded my arms and stood still. Presently he spoke to his men and came forward. He carried a drawn sword. I signed to him to keep away, but he continued to advance. Presently he was so close I could see his face clearly. It was a narrow face, with dull grey eyes and a black moustache. He had a scar on his upper lip, and he was dirty and unshaven. He kept shouting unintelligible things, questions, perhaps, at me. I know now that he was afraid of me, but at the time that did not occur to me. As I tried to explain to him, he interrupted me in imperious tones, bidding me, I suppose, stand aside. He made to go past me, and I caught hold of him. I saw his face change at my grip. "You fool," I cried. "Don't you know? She's dead." He started back. He looked at me with cruel eyes. I saw a sort of exultant resolve leap into them. Delight. Then, suddenly, with a scowl, he swept his sword back. So, and thrust. He stopped abruptly. I became aware of a change in the rhythm of the train. The brakes lifted their voices, and the carriage jarred and jerked. This present world insisted upon itself, became clamorous. I saw through the steamy window a signal box hoisting its constellation of green and red into the murky London twilight. I looked again at his drawn features. He ran me through the heart. It was a sort of astonishment, no fear, no pain, but just amazement. I felt it pierce me, felt the sword drive home into my body. The yellow platform lights came into the field of view, passing first rapidly, then slowly, and at last stopping with a jerk. Dim shapes of men passed to and fro without.
"Euston!" cried a voice.
"Do you mean..." There was no pain, no sting or smart. Amazement, and then darkness sweeping over everything. The hot, brutal face before me, the face of the man who had killed me, seemed to recede. It swept out of existence.
"Euston!"
clamoured the voices outside.
"Euston!"
The carriage door opened, admitting a flood of sound, and a porter stood regarding us. The sounds of doors slamming, and the hoof-clatter of cab-horses, and behind these things the featureless remote roar of the London cobblestones came to my ears. A darkness, a flood of darkness that opened and spread and blotted out all things.
"Any luggage, sir?" said the porter.
"And that was the end?" I asked. He seemed to hesitate. Then, almost inaudibly, he answered, "No."
"You mean..." "I couldn't get to her. She was there on the other side of the temple. And then..."
"Yes," I insisted.
"Yes." "Nightmares," he cried. "Nightmares, indeed. My God, great birds that fought and tore..."